Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer. Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by Katie Bors and James Forsyth. So in a little over a month's time, Boris Johnson will be having his major reshuffle after his election victory. So who's in and who's out and how big of a reshuffle will it be? Katie, do we have any ideas?
So I think there's several things going on behind the scenes. I don't think final decisions have been made yet, but over the weekend you had Boris Johnson go to Chequers, his Grace and Favour residence, and meet with some senior members of his team along with some officials to discuss the various changes. Now, the Whitehall reorganisation feeds into the cabinet reshuffle in the sense that clearly if your department goes, you don't have a job. Now, it does feel as though increasingly what before Christmas was being discussed as a mass Whitehall reorganisation is being diluted. And you're not actually going to see such a shake-up of departments or new departments. And I think that is in part because there's a view that given this government is very conscious that they need to deliver on many of its pledges to keep these former Labour voters who lent their vote and ideally then win another 5 years in power. And on top of that, also deliver Brexit and go through a second round of negotiations. I think there's limited bandwidth and they worry that if you create all these new departments, you actually perhaps waste a lot of energy or perhaps energy you should prioritise elsewhere doing this. And I think if you look at DEXI, for example, the Department for Exiting the European Union, I mean, it wasn't really a great success, to put it kindly. It became a place that civil servants who weren't really going anywhere would go there. You couldn't get the best there. And it is now being closed down. So I think if you are going to create new power bases, new departments, you have to be very clear. And it is going to take a lot of energy to make them a success. So I still think you will see some level of reorganisation. I mean, there's a discussion over ultimately, again, pivoting back, what is driving this all? I think there's a huge focus on keeping these voters in the Midlands and the North. And in doing that, the government, I think their second aim after delivering Brexit is levelling up the country. That's what they keep saying. So do you need a new department to do that? A department for infrastructure, a department for the North, or can you do it with the current structure you have? In terms of the personnel and the ministers, there's a report over the weekend that there's actually a big push right now, going back to the red wall push, to try and bring up some of these new MPs. So people like Deanna Davidson, people like some of the MPs in Wales, the Wrexham female MP, and try and get these women on a path to promotion. Yes, they can't be a Secretary of State just yet, but what can you do so they start to, you know, climb the ladder? So I think that the government are conscious of that. In terms of the reshuffle, something I wrote about last week is the fact that usually when people try and save their jobs, they opt for various things, such as, you know, an impromptu speech. They might do a tour of the studios, perhaps curry favour with certain journalists, and perhaps flatter the Prime Minister. But I think all the signals from this number 10 is they want to use this majority of 80 to move away from even courting the media. And the metric that they are judging good ministers by is, can you keep your head down and work at your desk rather than score media hits? So I think that if you're looking at who's up and who's down, there is a small portion of this cabinet who are trusted. I think that's your inner circle. I think I've got Michael Gove in there, someone's in town for a big promotion. Dominic Raab as well, who I think are sanctioned to go out and do press. If you're not in that group, they don't really want you out there talking. And I think that various attempts to get your speech greenlit ahead of the reshuffle are probably facing obstacles. So if you think that you're seeing someone out there in the media who perhaps is not given approval to do that, they're probably heading to a tricky situation in a couple of weeks' time.
I think what Katie says about number 10's attitude to the media is right. I thought Matthew Paris pointed out in his Times column, you know, how not only how true Katie's analysis rung, but also this point that ministers are going to be kind of given more license to get on with doing stuff in their department. Boris Johnson is by nature a delegator. So I think you're going to see ministers given kind of more freedom to run their own departments than they have been previously. I think one of the reasons why the reshuffle is shrinking in size is that Prime Minister was never more powerful than before, just before they carry out a reshuffle. And the coming reshuffle, combined with the general election, and the gap between the general election and the reshuffle means an awful lot of secretaries of state have basically been to number 10 to say, whatever you want, I'll do it.
They've been working very hard.
Yeah, and also but making clear that they're prepared to implement number 10's agenda. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a kind of crucial point. You know, if you look at Ben Wallace, someone who there was a lot of speculation about in the run-up to the election, you know, Boris Johnson, Ben Wallace, old ally Boris Johnson, given a big job, lots of talk during the campaign that Boris Johnson felt that Ben Wallace had, you know, been kind of, you know, and not responded in the way that he would have liked, been too kind of confrontational with him. The MOD had fought number 10 too much on some stuff. You know, post-election, you look at Ben Wallace's political thinking podcast, Nick Robinson, his Sunday Times interview with Tim Shipman yesterday, it's very much on number 10's messages about defence transformation, about the different ways it should be done. You know, and that is a sign of where that is happening. Some other ministers have saved their jobs by getting things done. You know, to take Julian Smith, another person who was on a shaky nail, you know, he has now got power sharing back up and running at Stormont, allowed the restoration of devolution. You know, the sentence in Boris Johnson's statement welcoming him on Saturday basically said this wouldn't have happened without the Secretary of State of Northern Ireland, which is a sign that, I mean, Julian Smith will, contrary to what people would have thought during the campaign, people would have thought a majority of 80 men that Julian Smith was in deep trouble, will now survive. So I think you're seeing here how this reshuffle is shrinking in size. I mean, the bigger question, which is the very interesting story in the Times on this today, is this question about, you know, how differently is government going to work? And you know, you talk to people who sat in those no deal prep meetings, and they say that they were different because they had this, they kind of literally had a board, and the meeting, it's a general good rule for life here, says anyone who sat for a newspaper conference would agree, the meeting had to come to a conclusion on a point. And it just, you know, and that, they felt, drove change and also created greater accountability because it was clear whose responsibility of this stuff was. So I think you'll see more of that. I mean, there's also another question for number 10, you know, which is, you know, how many of these shuffles do they think they will be doing between now and the next election? Because on Katie's point, you know, if you want some of these new different figures to be, you know, on the airwaves come the next general election campaign, you want Sarah Afton, the MP for Wrexham, first female Tory ever elected, you know, as Welsh Secretary, for example, you know, these people need to progress up the ladder at a certain rate. And so in a way, part of this question is, you know, how many of these shuffles do you intend to do between now and the next election?
And Katie, James mentioned just now that Ben Wallace interview with the Sunday Times. What did he say in it?
So Ben Wallace was talking about the UK's role in terms of foreign affairs and engagement with other countries and potential conflict. And I think one of the main takeaways was the fact that the UK can't rely on the US in the way it has in the past. And that is partly because you now have Donald Trump and taken a more isolationist view. And as a result of that, the UK has to be ready to work with others. And I think you could read it as work more and rely more on European allies rather than the US. Now, I don't think it's saying we're closing the door to America on this, but it was making the case, perhaps helpfully, that the UK has to have a strong defence force itself, which if you're a defence secretary and trying to make sure your department's budget is not cut ahead of a review is a good point to make. But also just, you know, in terms of the place in the world of the UK, which I think is something which, as James touched on, chimes with what number 10 is pushing. I think one of the interesting things we should be looking out for in the coming weeks is something that James talked about in his Sun column, which is the decision to be made over Huawei and the 5G network the UK wants to hold. And ultimately, is it a security issue? Because if you look at this relationship between the UK and the US, the US have been very clear that they do not think the UK should be joining forces or allowing Huawei as a Chinese company to have this level of access. And I don't think you could get a glimpse from that which way the government is heading, but is it going to be such a problem that if the UK goes ahead with this, because we do accept a decision to be made in the coming weeks, that they would then be closed off from intelligence sharing with America, or can they do so and maintain that? And I think that's one of the things going to weigh the balance of.
So, James, I mean, on that point about Huawei, Andrew Parker, the outgoing MI5 leader, gave an interview to the FT saying that he doesn't actually believe that the US would stop sharing intelligence with us if we went ahead with Huawei. Do you think he's right to think that? I mean, the US has made it pretty clear repeatedly that that's what something they would do.
I still think that the vast majority of intelligence sharing would continue. The question is, does it? What effect does it have at the margin? And I think that the point is there is a kind of technical difference of opinion between the UK intelligence services and the US and Australian intelligence services, mm-hmm. or the US and Australian governments, I should say. I'm not sure who thinks what now. But the US and Australian view is this is beyond my level of as a humanities graduate, my level of technical know-how. But the thinking goes as follows, which is, in the US and Australian view is that the very nature of the way that 5G operates means that there isn't really a core and a periphery.
Mm.
That essentially, if you're in the network, you're in the network, regardless of whether you're just the base stations or the antennae. The UK view is, no, it's fine to use Huawei for base stations and antennae because we can keep it out of the core, the sensitive bit of the network. And I mean, that is the tension between the UK and the US and Australian view. I think one of the other things which is interesting is some of the more hawkish people in government worry that because the government is on such an ambitious programme for the rollout of 5G and fibre, they are now in a position where they need Huawei. That like the view is the one hawk in government. You know, it's not realistic how quickly the government wants to do it, but it means it can't. It's boxed itself in, because how do you do it at that speed if you're going to take out one of the biggest providers in the world, Huawei, from being involved? I mean, this is another tension. I think the kind of question here becomes this, which is essentially, the UK has no more important security relationship than the Five Eyes intelligence sharing network. It is clearly, I think, at some point you need a certain level of coordination about what you think is safe and what you mm-hmm. don't think is safe. And if the US and the Australians take the view that this is not safe, then I think it would be foolhardy for the UK to ignore their concerns.
So the government is expected to make a decision on this later this month. James, is it very much still a live issue for debate in the government?
I think it is. I mean, we had a senior US official, a national security official, in town last week lobbying. There are more coming to town this week. You know, people are trying to make the point about why this is ill-advised. I think one of the things you'll see with Boris Johnson, though, is a kind of, he doesn't like these binary choices, and he will not like the idea of basically saying to China, you can't be involved in this, because that would obviously, for Huawei it's not involved, that obviously has a big knock-on effect for the rest of UK-Chinese relations. And so I think he will be inclined to find a kind of way of basically saying to the Americans, look, they're not in the core of this, internet. But yeah, I think we wait to see. And I think given the intervention by Andrew Parker from MI5, we understand that GCHQ say the same view.
Mm.
I mean, at the moment, unless we get into a situation where where this gets to a president prime minister discussion and the consequences of it are made very clear, I think the UK view will probably be limited Huawei involvement.
So I've spoken to some Tory MPs who are a bit more hawkish about Huawei. They don't really think that is a good idea. And we remember, of course, that Gavin Williamson was fired essentially from his role last year over a dispute over this. So Katie, how is the Conservative Party reacting to this possibility that Boris Johnson might just be another Theresa May when it comes to Huawei?
Well, look, there are clearly some in the Conservative Party who do think there should be a much firmer approach. But I think it just comes back to this crunch point, which is, if giving Huawei access on this means that the UK is going to be excluded from intelligence sharing with allies they've shared intelligence with for a very long period of time and is of huge importance, then I think that you will hear people speaking out and speaking loudly. And I think that will be the driving focus. If, and we expect, American representatives to be in touch with the UK government about this, if there is a way to include Huawei, why keeping those intelligence sharing relations going with America and other countries, then I think it will be less of an issue. There will still be some who don't like it, but I think that it's only if it then leads to a change in how the UK works with other countries that I think it would really become a thing where lots of people want to speak out, because we are a majority of 80 territory, and I think that if you decide you want to make something your cause and start a rebellion, you have to feel very strongly about it.
Mm. And James, one other thing that Conservative MPs are not necessarily happy about is the terms of the power-sharing deal that have got Stormont back up and running. In it, there is a section about how to pursue the legacy of the Troubles and the British Army men who were involved in policing that time. Can you tell us about what's going on here?
So I think that one kind of long-standing long-standing issue has been this issue of kind of historical prosecutions of former servicemen for historical offences. There has been a big desire among Tory MPs for, you know, far greater protections for servicemen from prosecution, and the kind of concern being expressed by people such as kind of Marc Francois, for whom it was a big issue in the last parliament, is that, you know, that this deal risks kind of reopening that question, leading to more servicemen being subjected to investigation. I think the kind of crucial difference, the crucial point, is no one should be subjected to vexatious prosecutions. But there is a different question about when something which is kind of more of a straightforward crime, I think, has been committed. I also think that there is fundamentally a difference between operations in Northern Ireland. You know, that Northern Ireland is part of the United Kingdom, and I think people say, oh look, it's not fair because you've got IRA terrorism on the run letters, etc. I personally think we should hold our own armed forces to a higher standard than those of terrorist groups. But I think the crucial point is, what is not realistic is to investigate, you know, it is things that have either been investigated previously, or things where there is no realistic chance of any kind of prosecution. I mean, that is the distinction that needs to be maintained.
And James, just tell us a bit more about that power-sharing deal that has been struck, thanks to Julian Smith. What does it say, and what does it mean for Northern Ireland?
I think essentially two things have driven this power-sharing deal. One is the fact that both the DUP and Sinn Féin feared that they would go backwards if there was another Assembly election, and the government was very, the UK government was very clear that one would be called if power sharing couldn't be got up and running. And the second is, you know, making clear that the money was linked, the money for, you know, dealing with specific problems in Northern Ireland, such as nurses' pay and the like, that was linked to getting power sharing back up and running. But, you know, I think in a way that perhaps the most impressive aspect of this agreement, though, is that all parties are now inside the executive. And that, I think, will make a big difference. This isn't just a DUP Sinn Féin duopoly. You've got the other parties in Northern Ireland taking up seats in the executive too.
James and Katie, thanks very much. And of course, today is also the deadline for the Labour leadership candidates to get their MP nominations. So we'll be back later today with a second podcast to see who has got through to that stage. Thanks for listening, and join us again later.